Jesse Marcel Jr. joined the U.S. Navy in 1962. He was assigned to the USS Renville and shortly thereafter participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis, attached to combat units as a member of the ship's company. The Renville then sailed for Westpac and then on to the Southeast Pacific area, where he participated in combat training in case of enemy attacks on the ship. After the Westpac tour, he completed specialty training, and here I go with this one. It's otolaryngology, I guess. That's the study of nose, ears, the throat, in any kinds of disorders and diseases. At the Naval Hospital in San Diego, California, that's where he specialized in that. Jesse retired from the Navy in 1971, entered private practice in Montana. He joined the Montana Army National Guard in 1973, went through helicopter training as a flight surgeon at Fort Rucker, Alabama, earning his wings in 81. During his career in the National Guard, he was also appointed the state surgeon of the state of Montana. Jesse is the son of the late Jesse Marcel, who was the first military officer at the 1947 crash site. And tonight he will tell his father's story and his own, the Roswell legacy. Let's introduce, first of all, Jesse Marcel, Jr. Dr. Marcel, how are you?
Very good, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good. And how did I get your specialty? Was I close?
That was close enough. You know, close enough for government work.
Okay. And let me introduce, of course, the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman. You all know him. He's been on the program before. He is an expert in investigating UFO cases. His websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. He's been a physicist. He has been all over the place working for Fortune 500 companies. And he's considered also the father of Roswell. He was the first to investigate the incident in 1978. Stanton Friedman back with us. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Well, it's early in the morning, 3 o'clock here, but I'm fine.
I always do that, too.
I've got a new story for you, George. I just have to... this is the cheap conspiracy story.
Okay.
This came over the wires, the CIA to air decades of its dirty laundry next week, which just happens to be when Roswell stuff will be starting.
Interesting.
A Washington Post article. It's a long article, and you'll be hearing all about all the dirty laundry from the CIA, all the bad things they did back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Bound to try to drown out Roswell, I think. Right, Jess? They're taking away our airtime.
I think so. No question about that.
Well, I'm going to be live in Roswell on July 6th, and you two, I trust, will be there, right?
I'm looking forward to it.
With Bell Zone.
Okay, great. And you're invited to come by the program when I'm on. One of the reasons we've got Stan tonight, of course, is he has written the foreword to the book, The Roswell Legacy. But just as important, Stan was the reason why that this whole story came out. Stan, you got to tell us this incredible story about how when you were, I believe you were where, in Louisiana? You were in a TV station studio promoting one of your college speeches. That's where I met you in 1971, as a matter of fact, in Detroit. You were there, and you found out about this case. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was really crazy. I was supposed to do 3 interviews at the station, and the first 2 interviews went off quickly, and then the 3rd reporter was nowhere to be found, and they didn't have cell phones back then. So the station manager is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the person that brought me to the station, and he knew I had other things to do. And out of the blue, out of his embarrassment, I guess, he suddenly says, "Yeah, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel." And great investigator that I am, I said, "Who's he?" And his line just knocked me over. He said, "Well, he handled wreckage of a crash flying saucer when he was in the military." What? You know. Well, tell me more about him. Well, he lives over in Houma. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. And, you know, the reporter showed up, so there was like a 20-minute window of opportunity there. The next morning, after a great crowd at LSU, I called information from the airport in Baton Rouge and got a number for Jesse and called him and talked to him. He told me his story, but he didn't have a precise date And he was the intelligence officer at the base in Roswell. And, you know, I knew there were loads of sightings in the summer of 47. Well, a few months later, I was in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody approached me about, did you ever hear anything about a crashed saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, I have. I got information, shared it the very next day with Bill Moore, who lived in Minnesota at that time. And Bill had a third story from an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an English publication, about an English actor named Newey Green, who, when driving across the country from L.A. to Philadelphia, heard on the radio about a crashed saucer in New Mexico. His son lived in Canada. Bill was able to dig out a date from him, like early July 1947. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library Periodicals Department, started looking. There was the story, verifying what Jesse had told me and giving us the names of other people who were involved. And that began a two-year quest. We talked to 62 people. This is before the Internet, so we found people the hard way. Before the first book came out, the Roswell incident, Bill and I did over 90% of the research, and the book was written by Charles Berlitz with Bill. And over the next five years, we located another group of people, was totaling up to 92, and we published papers at the MUFON network, and I'll be giving one about Roswell at this year's MUFON conference in August. It's on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And that led to the NBC program. I instigated that, the one about Roswell.
Right.
They did Unsolved Mysteries. And would you believe there were people who called into that program who had heard about it from one person or another?
Sure.
That led to a flood. My own book in 92, a new issue in 97, The Crash at Corona. And let me clear up something. People keep asking me, you mean Corona is different from Roswell? The crash occurred 80 miles or so from Roswell. The closest town, if you can call it that, is Corona, a small place. So we called our book, Don Berliner and I, Crash at Corona. It's the Roswell incident.
It's the Roswell incident. Okay, so at what point, let's bring Jesse in for a second. And Stan, you're more than welcome to stay with us all night if you want. I mean,
well,
you're...
if I can stay awake.
It's the invite is there. Jesse, in 1947, how old were you at that time?
I was 11 years old in 47.
Okay, so this is going to make you 70, 71 years old now, right?
Yeah, I'll be 71 at the end of August, and that's that's what it'll be.
I love the book, The Roswell Legacy, but what took you so long to write it?
Well, you know, I first started writing this book when I was in Iraq. I figured that, I'm getting older, and signs of mortality are all around me, as you might imagine there. So I thought, you know, I better get this down on paper before I go, because I would really like people to realize what the story meant to me and to my family. So that's when I started writing it, and it just basically it's the effect of what Roswell has on my family and hopefully the civilization of the world. But again, it was just because I realized that time is getting short, so I better get this thing down before it's too late.
How old was...
Better tell people what Jesse was doing in Iraq, Jess.
Sir? What's that?
He wanted to know what were you doing in Iraq?
I was a flight surgeon with an attack helicopter battalion, so I got a lot of flight hours in Black Hawk. As a matter of fact, I saw most of Iraq from the cockpit of a Black Hawk, which was very interesting. Probably the safest place to be at that time.
And I assume that's during the first Gulf War, obviously.
No, that's just this one that's going on right now.
Really?
Yes.
When they called you in, Jeff?
You know, I got called. You know, I retired from the Guard in '96, and lo and behold, when the Gulf War broke out again, they called me back into the regular Army this time as a flight surgeon, and so I went over to Iraq in, I guess, October of 2004. Finally got home in November of 2005, so I spent 13 months out there.
Jesse, you were 67, 68 years old right around then, right?
Right then, you know, I thought I was going to be the oldest guy out there, but no, there was another one, 73-year-old out there.
So I can't believe that.
I thought I was going to be the top honors in there, but now they had some guys older than I out there. So
I mean, you said that you were in Iraq, I'm saying, okay, maybe he was in 91. He was. No, I never would have anticipated this.
No, it was... home, as a matter of fact. So, as a matter of fact, my unit may be going back next year, and it's possible I might go back with them. I don't know.
Absolutely incredible. Well, good for you, and thank you for what you've done.
Well, it was a very interesting tour, and I would, you know, I'd go back in a heartbeat.
How old was Dad when he passed on?
Let's see, he was born in 1907, and he died in 86, so I guess 79.
So he's about 79 years old.
Yes,
okay,
huh?
All right. When you were this little 11-year-old boy, we're going to talk with you tonight in two fronts, Jesse. One's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old.
Uh-huh.
And then it's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the adult who's taken this Roswell legacy through these years. And Stanton, I'd want you to jump in any time because you're going to be the color commentator tonight in this program,
okay.
Right?
But well, I'm one of the few investigators that's been in the home of both Jesse Sr. and Jesse Jr.
Well, what's going to make this program so, I think, phenomenal is you, Stanton Friedman, have the nuances down about every little issue in Roswell, so nothing will be unturned tonight, and I'm glad you're with us. This is historical as far as I'm concerned. Historical for two reasons for me, Jesse. Number one, when I was a 21-year-old radio reporter in Detroit, Stan was my very first radio interview. They sent me to a college, and there he was, and I was fascinated with UFOs before I went in, and I was never the same when I came out. And in your particular case, knowing what your father did, it has been my lifelong ambition to interview you over all these years that I've been doing radio talk, which is now well over 10 years. I've wanted to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate your kind words.
You know, Stan would be on my programs 10 years ago, for example, and always talk about your father's case, and then he would start talking about you. So I'm glad you're here with both of us. But let's talk now about Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old. On the day of the crash, do you remember what your father said? I mean, did he start sharing some of this information right away, or did that take time?
That took a little time. But actually, no, this... what his job was to go out to the rancher for the Foster Ranch and pick up some of the representative parts of the debris. And as it turns out, our house was on the way back to the airbase. But this is about maybe midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning when he came back through town. And what he had done, he realized it's very special, that something we would never see again, which is right. He wanted to show it to my mother and myself. So he had pre-positioned a lot of this debris on the kitchen floor. Then he got my mother and myself up to look at this. So we got in there and looked at this. There's this metallic debris. He said, look at this. I think he used the word flying saucer. Not quite sure. But he wanted us to examine the debris for what it looked like. And, you know, first of all, he said, look for any vacuum tubes or any electronic components. Of course, he already knew there wasn't, but he wanted us to be satisfied about that. So we looked around there, you know, again, no condensers, resistors, vacuum tubes, or wires of any kind. And he said, well, look at this. You know, look at the foil and look at the little beams here. So I picked up the foil. I didn't try to bend it or tear it or stress it like other people did. I just, this is kind of strange-looking stuff. And, but I think the strangest part were the beams. It had looked like symbols written along the inner surface of the column there. And I remember at first thinking that was like Egyptian hieroglyphics, but no, it's not Egyptian hieroglyphics. And it's more like... geometric symbols of some kind. So, but these were imprinted along the inner surface, and I do remember the distinct color. They were like a purple-violet hue, kind of reflective of the light that was in the overhead in the kitchen there.
Did your father, Jesse, ever say at that time, this is a balloon, this is a military U.S. craft, this is something Earth-made, man-made?
No. This is something very unique. You know, if it was that, he would not have taking the time to bring it by the house. So
he told me in our first conversation that what was strange to him is that when he went out to the crash site, he couldn't find anything conventional. He'd been at plane crashes before. He was in a plane that got shot down. I think Jesse Jr. shares that distinction. And there wasn't anything that you'd expect from a military aircraft crash. Nothing conventional. That's important.
And what's important tonight, too, and I want everybody to understand this, we have all kinds of guests on this program. Some are entertaining. Some are very darn right scientific. we're talking with a medical trained doctor who has no reason to make up this story on things that he saw and heard from his father, who was the first military officer on the crash. And Stanton, I think that's so important. I think Jesse may be one of the most credible witnesses we've ever had.
Oh, of course. No question about that.
Well, thank you.
So,
yeah, we need more like Jesse to come forward, and I'm sure there's still some out there, incidentally.
Yes, that's true. Well, I guess, Jesse, your father never said that there were crash dummies at the site, right?
No, decidedly not. No dummies there. But that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is to maybe help trigger some people to come out and start talking about this. You know, the guys, the first-handers who are still alive, you know, come on out. You know, test the waters. It's fine. Tell what you know. Let the people know what happened out there.
Stan, when you were talking to Jesse Marcel Sr., did he ever tell you what he thought this was?
Yeah, it was something not of this world. One of the early interviews with him that's on tape is in my movie, UFOs Are Real. We went to HOMA and filmed him in like 1978, late 78. And he explicitly stated that it was something not from this world. We didn't know what it was, but it wasn't from here. And he was, you know, he was an intelligence officer for the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. It was his job to know what was going on. He knew about the rockets over at White Sands. He had been at plane crashes. There was nothing normal, conventional, anything like that about what he saw. So he didn't say it's from Zeta Reticuli. I mean, I say that now in my new book. But
this
he certainly indicated it wasn't from Earth.
Stan, I want to get your reaction and Jesse's reaction also when we come back after the break. Earlier this week, we had Bill Burns on, the publisher of UFO Magazine. You both know him. And Bill was telling us about the Walter Haut affidavit, apparently, that he signed, testifying exactly what Jesse Marcel Sr. has said, backed up now by another military officer who was there. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling.
It's in a new book. Witness to Roswell.
All right. Well, everyone, stay with us. This is, for me, a historical night on Coast to Coast. We'll be back with Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman. We talk about the Roswell legacy. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.